But right now we're joined in the studio by our next guest. His name is Dr. John McCrill, who he is an expert in genetic diseases. He's also a lecturer in the Department of Physiology in UCC and a scientist. Dr. McCrill, you're very welcome to be with us today.
Thank you very much for the invite, Anna.
Now, I suppose we had mentioned a little bit earlier on that we had a recent Rare Diseases Day, a National Rare Diseases Day. How many rare diseases actually are there?
Well, at the moment, it's estimated there are about 7,000 rare diseases, but some of them are so rare and some cases are not defined. So it's difficult to put an exact number on. When I first started looking at this a few years back, the number was 6,000.
Okay.
So the number's changing. So the estimate at the moment is around 7,000, but that's likely to increase the more information we gather on things like human genomes.
Now, there are a few experts on rare diseases. I know yourself, you have an in-depth knowledge of some and a good background on quite a good proportion. How did you come to be interested in studying this topic?
Okay, so I'm a scientist. I guess I fell in love with science when I was very young. I guess I'm very interested in life and the mechanisms by which living things work.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's the basis of physiology, really. So my connection with Ireland is I'm actually from London, is I was looking for a job after my PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key figures in research into a rare disease was offered a job at the time, so his name is Professor Tommy McCarthy from the Department of Biochemistry in UCC, and he actually was one of the first people to identify a mutation that caused a disease that's associated with the system I look at. And the system I look at that I'm most interested in is how nerves cause muscle contraction.
Okay.
So this disease is called malignant hyperthermia. And it's what's called a pharmacogenetic disease, and it's basically triggered by volatile anesthetics, so anesthetics that are used during surgery. And what it does to people who are susceptible, people who have the mutation, is make their muscles contract uncontrollably, unconsciously, and what that does is increase body temperature, and the increase in body temperature can be lethal. Before a drug was available for the treatment of this disease, it used to be the most common cause of death on the operating table. But a drug was developed in the 1970s and it's now routinely employed when these cases were observed. So it's an example of a kind of success story in some ways.
Yeah.
And there's certainly an Irish connection as well. But from a personal point of view, I'm interested in mechanisms, how things work. And often diseases, this sounds cold-hearted, but often diseases tell you about how systems operate within the body. And often there's a feedback between the two. If you know how a system works, you have more of an idea of how to fix it, how to repair systems.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are obviously challenges working in this area. I mean, with most sicknesses, doctors are a step ahead of the patients. They know when they come in a pretty good idea of what's going on. But with a rare disease, often the expert may never have seen these symptoms before, or might it be only the second or third time. How do they work within that field?
Okay, so as I mentioned, I'm a scientist rather than a clinician, so I wouldn't have any experience of dealing with patients, but what I do know is, you're right, some diseases are exceptionally rare. I was looking before the program to find the rarest, and there's one called ribose 5-phosphate isomerase deficiency, and there's only been one case ever diagnosed in the world, so
Wow. That's
a prevalence of 1 in 10 billion or whatever the world population is at present. So a case like that would be very hard to define, let alone diagnose and treat. So it is a real problem. And I was also reading, there was a meeting on rare diseases funded by the Health Research Board in 2012, and I was reading the notes from that meeting, and basically definition and diagnosis is one of the big problems with rare diseases.
Mm.
So how do you deal with it? I guess specialists would specialist training, you know, some consultants that are familiar with those particular diseases, more training for people who are at the patient interface as well, I guess.
Like experts like yourself, do you kind of have that red flag when you see something, you automatically know this is new, this is different, this is probably along that rare disease area?
Yeah, you would. You'd kind of you often see associations between things. I can give you an example. So the muscle disease I was talking about earlier, it's one of the diseases that's caused by mutations in the gene that encodes a molecular switch, and this switch is called the ranitidine receptor. There are also other forms of muscle disease that are have different mutations in the same molecular switch, and what they do is cause muscular dystrophy, of forms of muscular dystrophy, one of which is called central core disease. And in this you see hypotonia, which means kind of floppy muscles, and you see you eventually see and often severe cases of wheelchair bound because their muscles can't develop force, and you often see kind of premature death due to respiratory problems because muscles are involved in breathing in moving your lungs in breathing. There's an extremely rare form of disease associated with this switch called rigid spine muscular dystrophy, and there's a related form called multiminicore disease. And one of the pieces of research I was involved in, Tommy McCarthy, my first boss, actually noticed there was a similar disease that was connected to another component, another type of switch called selenoprotein N1. And the work I was involved was in collaboration with people in University of Utah and a few other universities, was to try and see if they were linked in any way, if they worked together in any way. And we basically found that they did. They were part of the same sort of system.
Yeah.
So that's one example from my own field. You look for connections between things, and you look for similar symptoms. And they're not always caused by the same things, but sometimes they point to a common kind of pathway of disease.
Yeah.
So that's from a personal perspective. That's it.
And I suppose just going on what you were just talking about there, linking up with others in different countries, I suppose because you are dealing with something that is so rare, you have to go outside of your own sphere, outside of your own city, outside of your own country, and work with others across the world. And as you said, we all looked at what is this switch, what connection can we make here?
Absolutely, and in some ways it's one of the pleasures of the job. Some scientists are extremely territorial and will defend that they won't want to collaborate with other people. But I think collaboration is one of the keys in dealing with rare diseases. You're absolutely right. You know, if you're dealing with a population that's only 4 million, like in Ireland, and you're dealing with a disease, rare diseases are defined as having a prevalence of 1 in 2,000 or less. Some of them, like the diseases I've just mentioned, the prevalence is probably around 1 in 50,000 people. So you know, in Cork, maybe 4 people have the disorder. So collaboration is the answer, bringing together information. And one of the other things we were talking about before the show is how important information is. And I guess one of the big benefits we have at the moment is we're living in a multimedia internet age, so information's easy to come by. One of the problems, though, is making sure the information is of high quality. So, and in terms of rare diseases, charities that are set up to support people with those diseases and their carers and their parents often have detailed information that's accessible to the patients and the carers. So that'd be a good place to start, as well as medical professionals, as well as clinicians.
And I suppose you're right in the sense of, how, the communications have developed so far, that they're a huge benefit, and possibly as well for the families. And is that also why we recently had the Rare Diseases Day, to kind of bring that awareness again?
I'm not directly connected with the Rare Disease Day itself, but I've read lots about it over the past few days, and basically they aim to promote information, so to help, for example, medical professionals with diagnosis of rare disease, and patient support, and advocating support of the patients for other means as well. So, for example, with really rare diseases, it's unlikely that they're will be an immediate kind of drive to develop drugs, because pharmaceutical industry is all about profit. There are some examples of kind of more benevolent activities from pharmaceutical companies, but often the most important thing is support and making sure that individuals suffering from diseases have a good quality of life.
Yeah.
And again, that's often a kind of government issue. The government has to make decisions on what they target and how they deal with these cases as well.
Mm. So how do families cope with that? How do parents cope with that? You know, if their child has been diagnosed with a rare disease, how can they cope with that isolation? You know, as you said, it could be very rare indeed, and there may only be one or two families in the city or in the country.
Okay, so often the charities are the most important thing. So the charity I'd know most about would be Muscular Dystrophy Ireland. So they deal with the various muscle problems that I've talked about, and many others as well. And they bring together support groups. So support groups involving kind of patients and their carers and their families are often one of the most important bodies in dealing with these rare diseases. And sometimes, like you've mentioned, some diseases are so rare that those support groups might be a worldwide kind of support group rather than even an Irish or a European group, you know. So that's only from my viewpoint as well. I've been quite fortunate in that very limited exposure to rare diseases within either mine or my wife's family. So I can only say what I'd conjecture really if.
What would be some of the challenges that you see moving forward, particularly in the area of research and development?
Okay, so one of the problems with research is the expense. Research is very, very expensive. Some people would be shocked about how much it costs. So the answer to that is collaboration, is for groups to work together. And for example, there's a medical research charities group, which is an umbrella of several different rare diseases charities that work together, and they work with the Health Research Board, so a government funding body for research, to try and fund research. So it might be that in some years one particular aspect won't be funded at all, but at least someone will be. Working with other countries, I guess there's a big push on at the moment in science for funding between European countries, for example. So working together is the answer. If a disease is really rare and resources aren't available for it, then collaboration is the answer. And it's collaborations often lead to the fastest kind of diagnostic methods and treatment methods.
Mm. And is there a challenge in keeping ahead? As you said, you know, when you were looking at the amount of rare diseases, that figure is going up. So how do you even stay ahead of that?
Okay, so as a scientist, which is relatively easy because you normally have a focused area, you're normally interested in one particular aspect of it. So in my case, I'm interested in these switches that work in the muscles and the heart. Even in that case, though, there's so much information, things change so much. I work on a tiny area of how the body works, and even so, there are, I think, 10,000 publications that are directly related to it. So staying ahead of even that amount of information is tricky. But for clinicians, it's perhaps even harder. But I guess with clinicians, there's communication with other experts. If they encounter a rare disease that the clinical data don't match up with anything they're expecting, they probably know a colleague that they can communicate with to help with the diagnosis. But you're right, it's a big problem. Staying ahead of the curve is really hard. I said, I'm not a clinician, but I'd imagine it's extremely hard to be to cover all of the 7,000 rare diseases that are known at present.
But there is, I suppose, the fact is that there is hope. I know you mentioned about that particular muscle one with the anaesthetic, and now there is a drug, and it was at one time one of the most common reasons why people died under anaesthesia.
So there's always hope. It's one of the things that drives forward science. You know, there's scientific curiosity, and there's always the hope that the work you're doing will have benefits to the public, the world. I can give you another example. Again, I'm not really familiar with the area of cystic fibrosis, but it's one of the most common rare diseases, particularly in Ireland. Ireland has one of the biggest per capita populations of people suffering from cystic fibrosis.
And I suppose it's bringing the awareness as well, because we know that the supporters had a big battle to get the bed, so it did bring it to public awareness.
Absolutely. So that's important as well. This is the sort of thing that patient support groups can do and family groups can do, charities. And in the case of cystic fibrosis, for some of the mutations, for some of the mutations that cause the disease, there are now drugs that are clinically approved that have just been developed. I looked up January 2012. There's one called Ivacaftor, which is providing hope, and I think it's the first drug that's been approved by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States. So there is always hope. There is always hope that if an area has been studied and research is being done, then that drugs will be developed. I guess another aspect of the pharmaceutical industry is they often have a group of drugs called orphan drugs, and they're basically used for treat rare diseases. And yeah. there are certain incentives to encourage pharmaceutical companies to develop those as well.
Mm.
So for example, they have extended patent lifetimes and things like that to try and encourage them to.
Oh yeah, can be the carrot.
Yeah. So even though there's. Yeah, I guess even though there's an economic drive to it, it kind of encourages people to get over the cost benefit side of things, you know, and develop drugs to treat rare diseases.
Mm.
I guess one of the other things I've kind of mentioned a lot of genetic diseases, but there are also other rare diseases that are non-genetic. For example, I started my training in biology, so I did my degree in biology. So there's an extremely rare parasitic disorder called amoebic meningoencephalitis, which is a form of meningitis that's only 200 people have ever suffered from it, but it's still lethal. It's killed all 200 of those people.
Wow.
And it's due to just a parasitic organism called Naegleria fowleri. So there is about 20% of rare diseases are non-genetic. So I thought it's important to point that out while I'm here too.
Wow. It's such a huge area. And I know there are people listening today and they're probably thinking, you know, if I do want to find out more information myself, or if I, you know, if I have a family member who's suffering from a rare disease and I want to look for help, where do they even start?
Okay, the first thing, I guess, because we're living in the information age, you know, you can start off with a search engine like Google and just type in the name of the disease. And if you put another search term like Ireland, you might find a local support group. And often the websites of these charities often have detailed information. So Muscular Dystrophy Ireland, for example, has detailed descriptions of each of the diseases that will be covered under the umbrella of muscular dystrophies. So that's one source. For really in-depth information, you can go to certain government bodies, particularly in places like America. There's the National Institute of Health, which is an enormous center for every type of biological and medical information you can imagine. So you can get quite a lot of information from there too, if you want detailed technical information. But yeah. Often the best place to start is the charities that deal with the disease that you're concerned with.
Well, I'm sure it's been encouraging for people today to know that there is so much work going on behind the scenes. Very often we don't see the developments, or the developments can be slow in being seen, but there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely, there is, yeah. And I guess the thing is, it takes time. When you see scientific papers, they often have like 20 authors, and it might have taken those 20 authors a year of their time to kind of develop an idea. So it is very slow, but there is always hope as well. I guess that's one positive message I can give. There's always some form of hope, and where there's life, there's hope as well.
Yeah, that's definitely the best note to finish on today. Dr. John McCrill, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you see